Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone or Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
この国はすっかりダメになってしまいました。そこで今日は皆さんにちょっと殺し合いをしてもらいます。バトルロワイヤル。
やめ！嫌なやつだと思うかもしれないけど、他のみんなが怖いの。
みんなは必死になって戦って生き残る価値のある大人になりましょう。おじおじ、しっかりしてんじゃねえ。ごめんな、俺が殺した反則だよな。
バトルロワイヤル。
Welcome to another episode of the Projection Booth. I'm Mike White, your 7th grade teacher. I'm taking Class B over again. Let's be friends. We've got two transfer students, Rob St. Mary over here.
Oh, well, thanks for the necklace. How did you know this was my color?
And Coffin John over there.
Never trust adults!
And hello.
Listen up. This country's absolutely no good anymore. So the bigwigs got together and passed this law. Battle Royale. So today's lesson is... You kill each other off till there's only one left. John, here's your machine gun. Rob, you get a frying pan lid. Good luck.
Oh, man, just a frying pan lid? Well, what Mike's trying to say is that this week we're looking at Kenji Fukazaku's Battle Royale. This 2000 Japanese social satire tells the tale of a class of students who are selected by a lottery, put on an island, and are expected to kill each other off, or their lovely little necklaces will explode and kill them anyway in about 3 days. Well, why? Now the country's gone downhill. Unemployment is high, juvenile delinquency at an all-time high, but of course there's a lot more to it. So, John, why don't you tell us how you first saw Battle Royale and what your impressions were?
Well, actually, I was in Japan at the time. I got to see it on its first release. I lived over there from 1998 to 2005. Initially, I had heard of Battle Royale through the book because it had its own little controversy. A friend of mine, he wanted to see it partially because of the fuss, and plus it was a Fukasaku film. Fukasaku was already getting along in his age, and, you know, Battle Royale turned out to be basically his 60th and last film, by the way. And at the time, I thought the film was probably one of the best Japanese films I'd seen in the past decade or so. And I kind of still feel that way. It's arguably Fukasaku's best, and I think it deserves a place as one of the best in Japanese film history.
So, Sensei, why don't you do something for us and introduce us to some of these main characters in Battle Royale?
When you say Sensei, are you talking to me or to John?
That's right, you, sir.
All right.
I'm not a sensei.
Well, you said you were going to be our teacher in this episode, so teach, damn it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Sorry. Jeez. We've got pretty much, I would say, two main characters, though there's a third main character that kind of floats in and out between Nobu, who stabs his teacher, who's played by Takeshi. His name is Kitano in this movie. He comes in at the beginning and really, I think he's going to be a main character, but there's some really good foreshadowing when they try to take his picture and his head's cut off, because then shortly thereafter his head's blown off. He gets to demonstrate the powerful collars that help out keep the game interesting on Battle Royale. And then there's our two main characters. The guy's name is Shuya sometimes, but he's Nanahara other times. So it's like, I guess Shuya might be his first name and Nanahara is his last name. But
correct. Yeah.
Okay, good. He looks like an anime character to me. He's got these really soulful eyes and this kind of shag haircut and stuff. It took a little bit for me to take him seriously. I know that was just kind of a cultural bias kind of thing, but he's going to be our main character through this. And really where we see most of the action is kind of through his eyes. And then his girlfriend, Noriko, you know, cute little Japanese girl. And there's nothing really that sets them apart from everybody else other than that we just kind of focus in on them. There's not something special about these two characters. The thing that Nanahara has going on for him is that he's got a lot of loss in his life. You get to see that through some flashbacks. Actually, the way that they do flashbacks in this film is really kind of neat. But you get to see that his father commits suicide, and that's where he actually hooks up with Nobu. You get to see kind of a flashback, so we get a little bit more Nobu, where we see those two in a foster home. And then Noriko, I guess, she looks like she would be part of one of the more popular girl cliques, but you know, we find out later that she's been picked on quite a bit at school. As I said before, there's Kitano, who is the teacher. I love B. Takeshi. I love him in his directing work and his acting work. And to me, this is one of his best performances. I absolutely love him in this. He's got this kind of comic flair and then this very seriousness, and you never know where he's going to go in this film. And I think his last scene, not to give anything away, but his final scene is just absolutely brilliant.
The Nobu character in the beginning. Then when I first saw the film, the kid stabs Takano, B. Takeshi, in the hallway, and then the one girl who we find out later, Noriko, picks up the knife and she's kind of got it behind her back. Well, the thing is it seems kind of like apropos of nothing, at least in that scene when I first saw it. And I'm like, well, why is the kid attacking the teacher? And then when they get to the island before Kitano blows his head off to demonstrate to the rest of the kids sort of what the deal is, there's this dialogue between him. And I think that's what sets up that attack in the first part, where at least to me, and I wanted to kind of get your take on this, in the first part, it almost seemed like the attack was unprovoked. But later, when you get to the island and he has this conversation with him, it almost sounds like he was telling him, don't come to school, you're a failure, you should just drop out, just give up. And then that might be the reason why he decided to stab his teacher.
I think so. I think it also could be said that that scene serves to have the audience realize that the knife is a device, because the knife does appear later on in the film. I also kind of think that, of course, you know, the easier way to look at that particular scene, we're three Americans speaking here. We know that, you know, high school has gotten, or it appears to have gotten more violent, you know, at least if we follow what the news is telling us. You know, in reality, it's probably just about the same level it's always been. In Japan, also certainly the case that there was a rash of incidents involving high school students. One famous one being that one girl, I believe it was during detention period, basically cut the throat of another girl with a utility knife. And when they asked her, you know, like, why did you do it? The girl who she killed had like insulted her on the internet or something like that. And it was just seemed so senseless, you know. And I think that, you know, the film is trying to, and the book also is trying to sort of poke on these things, like all this stuff that's happening. You know, is it happening for a reason? Are children misguided? Are they angry about something? You know, and the film and the book sort of focuses that anger on, you know, all the lies that the adults have been telling them.
One of the things that I enjoy about this movie a lot is that it kind of takes that tension that's always there in high school, the cliques and all these different things, and just takes it to this really ridiculous level, which really isn't that far from reality, but takes it up to what if these kids were alone on an island with a bunch of weapons, this kind of Lord of the Flies scenario.
It seems like a commentary on the cruelty of children to each other, first off in the school setting, and then what happens if you just kind of let it go as far as it can. When we see some of these flashbacks, the kids are far more cruel to each other than maybe putting a gun to one of their heads. It almost seems like they destroy each other emotionally and as individuals first before they would ever destroy each other, quote unquote, in the flesh, I guess.
One of the most striking characters to me is Chigusa. The actress went on to be in Kill Bill, made a big impression with that. She's not in the movie that much at all, but her little part just really is very captivating. And I guess because she's got a lot of presence on screen for being such a young actress, but just that little segment of her, that scene that we get of her, just really hits home. That part affected me quite a bit. You know, even it, within this major story, this little story kind of got me, which I thought was very nice.
Yeah, the actress is Chiaki Kuriyama, who is actually, before she did Battle Royale, and of course during, and even now, she was a model, which is, you know, part of the reason why she has such presence. And, you know, she's gone on to, as you said, Kill Bill, and she's done a lot of TV work. I'm glad that you guys are touching on this aspect of the film, because really, you know, as we mentioned earlier, this film gets its attention mainly from its violence. You know, everyone says, you know, talks about how bloody it is. It is a bloody film, like I said. And again, I'll have to reiterate that it's not gratuitous violence, in my opinion. But, you know, one aspect of the film that you guys are touching on here is that it's basically, behind all its blood and everything, a real, very much like a soap opera. You know, when I was first watching it, I remember in theaters, I was thinking, you know, this kind of feels like a TV show in a way, but it just has a lot of violence surrounding it. You know, all these human dramas and these little, and these cliques and stuff like that. It really served to, one, the actors being very young themselves. I think the oldest actor at the time was like 25 or 6. You know, I think it's that immediacy of them being young that makes the drama in the film so good. You know, it really brings back those memories of when you were young and when you had that crush on Mike, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, Mike, did you get my cookies, by the way?
I've been eating the bag this whole time, so.
Good man.
Thank you for that.
But that's, I think, part of the reason also why it works so well is that the kids are kind of still uncomfortable in their skin at times. And it is that sort of awkward stage of being a teenager. And the fact that he went ahead and casted kids that were literally kids, as opposed to doing what we do in American film, where we get people who are in their mid-20s and ask them to play 16, is, I think, quite a testament to the way of doing things, and especially the way Fukusaku does in this film.
Yeah, it was very fascinating seeing some of the behind-the-scenes stuff where it was just him yelling at the kids, basically, like, okay, you're going to react over here, and, you know, just these kind of really broad emotions that he was going for in a lot of these scenes, but it worked. And yeah, it reminds me, you know, we had talked about The Killer on the show a few months ago. It kind of reminds me of that, where it was that mix of violence and melodrama, and that might turn some people off, but it definitely worked for me. The other thing that I find interesting is that, you know, this whole thing, this whole battle has been set up by the parents, and you really don't get a real sense of parental figures in this film at all. I mean, you get Nanahara's father, who kills himself, and then you get Kitano, who basically is being beat up by his kids via the phone, but that's it. I don't know if you guys see that as this is kind of a playing out of all of societies, all of Japanese society's conflicts on this one island, if we're seeing a good cross-section of what the problems are.
You can almost feel like the children being puppets of the adults. I would say that this film very much addresses this sort of, I guess you could call it, a generation gap that's in Japan. For example, this is how Fukusaku, the elder Fukusaku, because his son wrote the screenplay, but this is how Kinji Fukusaku's contribution really comes into play. Fukusaku grew up basically during the post-war era. I believe he was in his teens at the time, you know, and this is, of course, mid-40s after World War II. Back then, they basically had nothing after that. They had to surrender everything mentally, as well as philosophically and physically in a way, too. The next generation is people who grew up, let's say, in the 70s and 80s, the developing Japan. Everything was flourishing. You know, people were making money left and right. And then that generation represents what you can call the Battle Royale children's parents' generation. So the parents are basically, at this point, feeding the children these things about, you know, this is how society is. You make money, you have a family, blah, blah, blah. During this era, you might recall that, you know, there was the big, the Asian banking problem, you know, where all the Asian economies basically tanked. So you have these children who grew up during this post-economic destroyed economy era, And that's almost parallel to Fukasaku's post-war era, you know, where the parents are telling you, you know, do this, do that. You know, this is how you succeed. You know, life is a game. You know, that's what they say several times in the movie. Life is a game. Life is a game. And you have these kids who don't understand how to make money, how to have families, how to do this, because there's nothing in society that they can see that allows them to do so.
There's only really one scene that we get any sort of interplay between the parents and a kid, and that is the scene with Nanahara where he goes to dinner with his dad. He has this flashback scene before his dad kills himself. And he seems very much, as you were talking about, with this whole like collapse of maybe along with sort of the Asian banking and all of this stuff that happened, this depression or really bad recession that happened in Far Asia, that maybe he represents that in some way, or that's what his job was. We really don't know. But he's at this dinner and they're trying to figure out what they're going to eat. And the waiter's kind of like, what do you want? And he's really edgy and he kind of like screams at the waiter and all this. And he's really kind of sullen and sunk over in his shoulders. And you really kind of get the feeling that he maybe stands in for the parents, since we don't see any other parents. And maybe this is, the parents are so sort of defeated and beaten down in some way in this society that their kids are out of control, but maybe it's not their fault that the kids are out of control because they don't know what the hell to do. They feel sort of neutered or inept in order to take care of their own lives and therefore take care of their kids.
I think in a way that Fukasaku is probably empathizing with these rebels the most, well, the rebels as well as Nanahara and Noriko, again, who have their bonds, right? Because these are the people who survive through not following the game, you know, by trusting each other in the case of Shuya and Noriko, or just rebelling against the system as represented by the hacker group.
The reactions of the kids when they're sent on this mission basically is really interesting. I mean, just how quickly some of them turn into killers. I mean, the kid with the crossbow right out of the gate, who's just absolutely nuts and just screaming and carrying on and, you know, falling, tripping over himself, literally trying to kill his fellow classmates. And yeah, it was just so sad to see how different people embrace the game, and when you rebelled against it, you were kind of put into place. Our guest, Linda Hoagland, really had a very interesting look at that. She specifically calls out those girls in the lighthouse. So let's take a break. We're going to come back with that interview that Rob and I did with Linda Hoagland, who's a fan and friend of Kenji Fukasaku's. She translated several of his films, including Battle Royale, into English, and is really one of the leading subtitlers of Japanese film in the world.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOF at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out adamandeve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at adamandeve.com.
After Movie Diner promo, take one.
John Wayne here from the Brannigan Podcast. Has anyone seen the full Vernon?
No, try again.
Sweaty Vernon here from the...
No, come on.
Hey, how's it going? I'm Matt Ringler from the Schlock Treatment Podcast. Hoping you'll tune in to After Movie Diner. It's my favorite podcast.
Better, but also at the same time completely useless. Try and mention the movie reviews, the interviews with independent film directors, things like that.
Matt Ringler from the Schlock Treatment Podcast here. Hoping you'll turn in for a...
It's tune in. Christ. <Turn in.
laughs> Matt Ringler from the Schlock Treatment Podcast. Hoping you'll turn in. Thing, turn
in. How hard is it just to plank the damn show? Do it right. I'm going to come down there and nail your face to the fridge.
Listen up, folks. Matt Ringler here from Schlock Treatment. I want to tell you about a great podcast, The After Movie Diner. There's plenty of pie and everything's delicious, especially the host, the sweaty Vernon.
No. I mean, he didn't even mention that the podcast is available every Monday at amdpodcast.blogspot.com and iTunes. Idiot.
Hi, I'm Lance Henriksen, and you're in the projection booth.
Thank you. as you know, I grew up in Japan, and because my parents were missionaries in rural Japan, and they didn't want to send us to a dormitory American school, they sent us to local Japanese schools. Because my parents wanted to make sure that we were bilingual, we couldn't speak Japanese at the dinner table. So I grew up translating everything that had happened to me in Japanese school into English, you know, to tell my parents what had happened in English. So for me, you know, interpreting Japanese experience into the spoken English language is kind of like breathing. There's just, my brain is involved, but to me it feels more like breathing than thinking. It's instinctual. And so I guess I always, you know, I would watch Seven Samurai and go, you know, I don't think that's what he's saying. And I just had a kind of a real problem with a lot of subtitles that I saw for Japanese films, even kind of the great Japanese classics. And so I would come out of watching one of those films exhausted because I would be typing the correct subtitles as I watched the movie. So I'd be listening in Japanese, watching the bad English subtitles, and, you know, totally revising the subtitles in my brain. Then finally, I had a chance to subtitle a film in 95. There's a great film that I think is also Netflixable called Music for the Movies, the music, film music of Toru Takemitsu. I went with the director Charlotte Zwerin to Japan and interpreted all of the interviews with the great film directors, including Oshima and Kobayashi and Teshigahara, and then subtitled that film, and I found that I really liked it. Oh, and then what happened is I met Koreeda right after his first film, Mabaroshi, had won a prize in Venice. And then I started to travel with him on the film festival circuit and started meeting different Japanese producers, and they had never seen an interpreter like me. I would be interpreting for the Q&A, and then they just started to recruit me to subtitle. And then I had started subtitling a lot, which was why I had the opportunity when the 98 retrospective was happening at Rotterdam to subtitle five of Fukasaku's films in a row. And it's interesting because, you know, when you subtitle five Fukasaku films in a row, I had a sort of a personality transformation. It was like, you want to fight? Because his movies are about fighting and not ultimately winning, but like, don't lay down your sword or your gun or your weapon until you've given it a shot. And I think that is what flies in the face most directly of the average American stereotype about a Japanese person. I mean, you know, there are all kinds of Japanese people, but Fukasaku was, you know, portraying that rage and that disappointment that about all the transformations that happened in the post-war. And that ultimately led to my having the great opportunity to re-subtitle all of the great Kurosawa films, including Seven Samurai. When Criterion was remastering them, there was a film screening sort of touring. So I think 15 films. But it's interesting, you know, because I asked Fukasaku once, I said, what do you think of Seven Samurai? And he said, you know what, I would have made a film about the bandits and how they became bandits. So, you know, right? That's a pretty good story, yeah. Right?
Yeah, definitely.
He's always interested in the marginalized outsider and why they wound up that way and what their motivation is and what their story is. He's like, okay, give me a bad guy and I'll give you a really interesting story.
How difficult is it to take something and reduce it down enough that you can put it at the bottom of the screen so that an American can read it and make sense of it? Are there any, like, ones that really kind of stand out in your head, any kind of scenes from the films that you did that were just kind of, like, way off, or is it just more of a tonal thing?
Fundamentally, it's tonal, because as in literature, you know, tone is everything. And so for me, I just hear and feel the tone of the way the Japanese person is speaking. And so what I'm presenting to you in English is the way a Japanese person would hear that Japanese dialogue. So it sort of lands in my Japanese heart, and then I convert that into the English language. But that's not so, it's not so arduous, because like I said, for me, it's akin to breathing. Certainly there is much to the craft of, you know, as I say, you know, you can always make it more concise. That's the idea about subtitling. There's always a word you can eliminate. There's always a way to edit it down into a more concise vision, because the goal is not to clutter the screen with as many words as possible, but to free the viewer's eye to watch the film. so concise is always better. I think it was in Stray Dog. No, it wasn't Stray Dog. What's the film before Stray Dog where Mifune plays a gangster and Shimura plays a doctor in a slum? You know, Shimura is the kind of the, he's the guy who recruits all the samurai in Seven Samurai. Mm-hmm. And he was very much a mentor to Mifune in real life. So Shimura goes in to try to rescue a girl who's kind of been held hostage by a gangster. And Shimura goes on a long rant. And the long rant is translated in the original as no.
Oh,
and what he's saying is, don't you understand you can't treat women like this anymore? We have democracy in Japan now. You have to treat her with respect. So talk about the loss of nuance. Yeah, that's just the kind of nuance that I think maybe the original subtitles, you know, subtitlers who were Japanese gentlemen who just didn't want to kind of dirty their hands with that kind of nitty-gritty dialogue. I think they thought it was beneath them, maybe. I don't know.
Drunken Angel?
Yes, Drunken Angel. Very good.
Okay.
That scene just has always kind of, you know, stood out in my mind as like, and the other thing that I did with Seven Samurai is that, I don't know if you were old enough to remember the old bad English subtitles to Seven Samurai, but basically the movie was as famous for being a brilliant movie as the subtitles were famous for being horrible. And what I did in that film was the whole, you know, the major subtext of that film is that there is an unbreachable gulf between the peasants and the samurai. And of course, that's why you have that doomed romance between the young samurai. And so linguistically, I created a vocabulary, one vocabulary for the samurai and one for the peasants. And, you know, the subtitles alone will tell you who's speaking in my subtitles. And then, of course, the Mifune character is the trickster and he's the joker. So his vocabulary tends to kind of waffle between the two. You know, he's a peasant who's a wannabe samurai. And so I just pay very careful attention to the kinds of words that are spoken depending on whether it's a peasant or a samurai. So that's the kind of strategic thinking that goes on if I'm subtitling a film.
You don't know how much respect I have for you when it comes to subtitling, because I've never actually subtitled a film, but I've done a lot of subtitle transcriptions from, say, a really bad print of a film to a new DVD release, or somebody has translated it for me and I have to figure out where the subtitles go. Uh-huh. And you're right, it is such an art, and just I've never been that original voice to take it from whatever the original language was to the English, and I can't even imagine that next level.
Well, you know, the other thing is, the other sort of guiding principle that I have is that, you know, Japanese people and culture and language and emotions are not exotic to me. My belief is every emotion that a Japanese person has is on screen is fully comprehensible to you as an American. So in order to break down any potential cultural barriers, I try to break it down so that you can understand it. So for instance, August 15th, in Japan it's a holiday called Obon. So if I wrote, say, on Obon or on August 15th, none of that is helpful to you. But if I say on the Day of the Dead, because we know that in Mexico they have something called the Day of the Dead, and that's what Obon is. It's the day when the spirits return. So I just try to create solutions that allow you inside that experience. You know, I guess because I grew up steeped in the Japanese experience, none of it is really exotic to me. And I feel that there's always a way to help an American viewer, an English-speaking viewer, fully enter the experience of the character. To get back to Battle Royale, I mean, I actually wrote an article about the film for Kinema Junpo, which is kind of the sort of mainstream Japanese film magazine, about how, in my mind, the way I saw it is that the film is Fukasaku's homage to why Japan has never been able to have a revolution. You know, there's never been a bourgeois revolution in Japan, and that is the source of many problems, actually. You know, we've had a revolution, the French had a revolution, but somehow in Japan it always got stymied, it always got crushed, And that's the way I read Battle Royale, is all the ways in which, and I feel like that scene in the lighthouse with all the girls killing each other is sort of the perfect metaphor for all the failed attempts at revolution in Japan. Splinter groups get set up against each other instead of joining together to overthrow a larger authority or evil or force. What's interesting is that, you know, at the time that Fukasaku made Battle Royale, he had been sidelined. You know, his career had really floundered. I think that's the only fair way to put it. Green Slime being part of the downfall. And what was the great thing that happened was that his son wrote the screenplay with him, Kenta, who's now gone on to become his own director. But I think because they were about 40 years apart, it was almost like a kind of a grandfatherly relationship. And the two of them really, you know, Kenta and Fukasaku used to talk about going to a cafe and ordering parfaits and battling each other with these long parfait spoons over different scenes in the film. And I think it was his working with his much younger son that you know, he was able to, Fukasaku, of course, brought this sort of magisterial structure, plot structure, and, of course, experience with action. But Kenta brought the kind of sort of almost 21st century ethos. So I think Kenta was able to help channel Fukasaku's rage in a way that made sense to, you know, 15-year-olds in 2000 or 2001. I can't remember when it was released. And that's part of the genius of that film.
There are a lot of metaphors going on inside of Battle Royale. So I'm curious to get your interpretation of, because this always sticks out to me as one really odd thing, is when they get to the island and there are those two extra classmates, the older kids.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. What do you see as those kids?
Well, they're clearly plants, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I think it's like the idea is that the game is rigged. It's supposed to be a free-for-all, but actually, they're clearly much, aren't they much older? It's been a while since I've seen Battle Royale.
Yeah, they seem to be older, maybe like they're seniors and these kids are freshmen or something.
Right.
And they're somehow more battle-hardened, right?
Right.
Well, one said he had been there like 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, no, I think it's a, you know, it's a metaphor for how the game is always rigged. By bringing those two in, it makes the two who survive, their survival much more miraculous at the end. You know, and they survived because they banded together. It was the two of them joining forces that allowed them to survive. And so somehow their, you know, unity allows them to beat out even this kind of rigged game of these much older battle-hardened guys.
Do you kind of see that maybe he's in Battle Royale setting up this thing where I expect the younger kids or the people in the Japanese culture to just follow along? It's like, here's the rules. This is what you do. You just follow the rules. You follow it through. There seems to be this sort of stereotype, at least in the American mind, that the Asian cultures are very regimented. When I watch Battle Royale as an American, I almost see that maybe he's making a statement on this over-regimentality, that we're going to put all these kids in this situation and they're just going to follow the orders.
Right. And that's why what he's always trumpeting is the possibility of resistance. The message of his film is always fight back, don't give up, you know, don't give in to that regimentation. As a person, he had the kind of personal authority and gravitas to go, what are you going to do, kill me? You know, he just had that kind of charisma. He had that kind of individual charisma that he was like, why should I follow your rules? And I think that's really the underlying message of every one of his films.
You knew him at this point when he started putting this together. This is around 2000. Do you remember what sort of the discussions were to maybe for the casting or whatnot? You have Beat Takeshi in it, and he's a director in his own right. To have him come in, I mean, he's a big name. He's an action director. I think that might show, and I don't know what the interplay was between them, but I think that may show a level of respect for Fukasaku from him.
I think the way to think about Fukasaku is that, let's think of him as like a prolific Terrence Malick. Do you know what I mean? Any actor in Hollywood, if Terrence Malick says, I'm going to make a movie, will you be in it? They all say yes. That's who Fukasaku was. You know what I mean? As famous as Takeshi is, Fukasaku says, I want you to be in my movie. He's not even going to think about it. And, you know, that despite the fact that by that point his career had been somewhat sidelined, I think certainly Takeshi was aware of his earlier movies and I'm sure considered it a great honor to be cast. I mean, I wasn't there for any of the discussions and I don't remember him saying anything specifically about it, but you can see from the way Takeshi acts in it, I mean, there's no irony. It's just he's there for Fukusaku.
I read in your article that when you first subtitled Battle Royale, that it was an early print of it, no sound effects, no music, any of that. And that version that you subtitled, was that the version that came out initially, or was that the version that came out later that has been called the director's cut?
You know what? I don't remember.
That's fair.
I have no idea what the difference is between the two films, but I was instantly captivated and... I remember showing a friend of mine, I don't think I actually lied, but I said, I have a trailer for a film, and I put on Battle Royale, and like 20 minutes into the film, she was like, this is a kind of a long trailer, isn't it? That movie has so much momentum, you know, it just grabs you by the throat. I think of it as a masterpiece. But I guess ultimately it is quite a violent film, but once again, to me... You know, it's have you guys seen the Iranian film called A Separation?
No, but I do know it won the Golden Globes.
Yeah, and it won the best film at Berlin. It won best actress. And, you know, once again, it's when you have a brilliant filmmaker who can write a screenplay that is functioning as metaphor the whole time, you're just sucked in. I mean, or at least I am. It's just a different order of filmmaking as far as I'm concerned. And so when I have that clear metaphor, that really guides me in terms of subtitling, because then I have to give the subtitles the elasticity in English for the American audience to get, oh, this is a metaphor. But you can kill a film with bad subtitles if you don't write the kind of language that allows an English-speaking audience to get it.
My initial viewing of it, to me, it was... a great meditation and discussion on the inhumanity that we do to each other as children before they even get to the island. Because there's all of this subtext amongst all the kids and how now that they have guns, they're trying to play out and move past, in some places, these wrongs that they've all committed to each other in some way as classmates. Not being steeped in Japanese culture like you are, I didn't see the larger, as you said, comment on middle class, lack of a middle class revolt in the country.
You know, I mean, I don't know how much you've seen in the news, but, you know, there are increasingly large anti-nuclear demonstrations in Japan. As you'll see when you see my film Ampo, you know, in 1960, there was a general uprising against the U.S. military bases. I mean, Tokyo looked like Cairo in February. Millions of people were demonstrating every day. You know, it's partly that this history of revolt and resistance, it's not taught in Japanese schools and certainly not taught in American schools. But Fukusaku is like, it's there. It's a real powerful element of Japanese history. And he has lived through it and lives and breathes it. And so for him, it's just natural. And I just think that you have to look at the superficial violence and appreciate what's going on beneath it.
I'm very curious about your take on Battle Royale 2, because I'll be 100% honest and just say I was not a big fan.
Well, you know, here's the thing you have to know about Battle Royale 2 is, first of all, Fukusaku passed away before the first day of shooting. His son took over, and I'm dear friends with his son, so no disrespect whatsoever, but, you know, his son had to deal with losing his producer, losing his director, losing his father, and then continuing to shoot the film. In fairness, Battle Royale 2 was made after 9/11, when all of a sudden, to Fukusaku and his son's dismay, any kind of revolution was considered terroristic. So I would say that Battle Royale 2 is a son's clumsy attempt to articulate and stake out a territory where there is still that legitimate need for revolution around the world.
I mean, I liked...
Is that comprehensible? Am I going to get, like, arrested? am I going to be on the no-fly list pretty soon?
I like some of the things that they were saying in the film, you know, especially like all of the underhanded, dirty politics that America has been involved in. It just, so much of it just felt like a, like, yeah, like a bad clone.
I think, honestly, that was, you know, Kenta, his son, being a rookie director, you know, out of his league. You know, yeah. he was trying to take on perhaps one of the most important questions of the 21st century, which is, what is the role of revolution in a quote-unquote terroristic world? You know, how do you delineate legitimate revolutionary impulse? And I think he was just out of his league. I mean, I think that's the kindest way to put it. Whereas, you know, I mean, if you look at all of the actors, all of the young actors from Battle Royale, Fukasaku just, you know, ripped into them and made all of them stars. I mean, all of those young actors are now total stars. And it's because Fukasaku was relentless, and he would show them personally how to do the stunts. He was very much of the old school. I mean, in that sense, he wasn't authoritarian, but he was like, I'm the boss, because I'm the director, and you're going to do what I tell you. You can see the actors that came out of that Battle Royale experience. They were never the same. In making my film Ampo, which is, you know, I'm an American making a film about Japanese resistance to U.S. military bases, I, you know, was very much, in my own mind, following in Fukasaku's steps, which is to be as courageous as you possibly can and just let go of your fear when you're making a film. Of all the people that I wish could have been on Earth to see Ampo, I wish Fukasaku could have been, because it's very much an homage to his filmmaking.
We talked about the violence to some extent. America is a pretty violent country. We have guns. A lot of people have guns. There's a lot of handgun violence in America. To my understanding, Japan doesn't have a lot of guns. I mean, you may have violence, but it's not as prevalent as maybe in America. How does a film like this kind of play into the culture of Japan, in that you have something that's kind of hyper-violent?
It was really criticized. I mean, I think there was a parliamentary motion to try to stop the film from being distributed because it was so violent. But Fukasaku just used it, you know, to sort of whip up publicity and say, you have to understand that what I'm talking about is something much deeper. It's a little bit of an overstatement, but there aren't really handguns in Japan. Policemen don't even really carry handguns. So, you know, it's very much of a fantasy. He was criticized, but that was his singular vision.
I was just wondering if you saw it as maybe a mirror in some way, or sort of an absurdist notion of where maybe a society could go, or that society could go.
Absolutely. Yeah, if you have enough people who are willing to follow rules, then when you make the rules absurd to the point of bizarreness and people are still willing to follow, that's where you end up. You know, like I said before, it's really his cautionary tale about the need for resistance. But he was not an art director. He was really a commercial director, and he was always calculating about how to get an audience to come to his movie. I mean, I think that's kind of the lovely thing about Fukasaku, is that he had the mind of an art film director, but the calculating heart of a commercial director, and also the chops to pull it off time after time, you know. A lot of his titles, though, I want to say that at least 15 are rentable, if not Netflixable. Maybe 15 is overstating it, 12. So I hope that you will try to clue your audience into this so that they get hooked with Battle Royale and Battles, but then go on to watch Under the Flag of the Rising Sun, Yakuza Graveyard, Graveyard of Honor, et cetera, et cetera.
For me, it's all about Message from Space.
Yeah!
Only the dubbed version, though. That's all.
I refuse to watch a dubbed version of any film ever.
I'm still trying to figure out what happened to the other space acorn, because one of them seems to be missing in the dubbing. I don't know. Unless there's like a director's cut of that one somewhere.
Well, it was a low point. Let's put it that way.
And amen on the no watching dubbed films. Thank you very much.
I think that one's only available dubbed, unfortunately. Like that and The Legend of Eight Samurai.
Well, but you know, I mean, I'm here to tell you that he died a beloved director. Obviously, I've never met Terrence Malick, but it would be hard for me to think about an American director who commanded such loyalty from so many filmmakers and actors. Everybody loved Fukasaku. And it wasn't because he compromised. He was a towering figure, and a certain era in Japanese filmmaking ended when he passed away.
Welcome back to the Projection Booth. It was great talking to Ms. Hoagland. We'll be hearing from her again in a few months when we cover Kenji Fukasaku's Battle Without Honor and Humanity series. If you're like Rob and I and are in Detroit, you might want to get up to the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor on Thursday, March 22nd, for a screening of her film, Anpo. It's free, and you can get more details about that on the Projection Booth website, Battle Royale. It's coming out here in the United States finally, officially, legitimately, in a few weeks, kind of cashing in on the upcoming Hunger Games phenomenon. Well, actually, Hunger Games has been a book and is finally getting turned into a movie. Not a big surprise. It was a very popular young adult series and really shares a lot of similarities between Battle Royale, between itself and Battle Royale. So I don't know if either of you guys have read the books or have, you know, followed on the previews and all this kind of stuff.
I have not yet, but I am going to soon. I work at a library and I'm supposed to keep up a certain number of books having been read. So I need to get on that pretty soon.
I'm not up on Hunger Games, but one of the things that was funny is I know someone who's doing press for the U.S. release, obviously, of the film. And she told me that one of the things they've tried not to talk about to the public is the fact that the kids kill each other. And I thought, I'm like, that isn't that the whole conceit of the entire picture? And she said that young kids who have read the books will come up and go, oh yeah, that's the, those are the books about the kids that kill each other on TV. And the press people are like, shh.
I think, John, you'll enjoy the books. Like I said, the first two are really good. And the third one, she didn't know what the hell to do to wrap it up. So if you can avoid the third one, I would recommend that.
The thing that's interesting about this Blu-ray that's coming out, it's supposed to have sort of the complete Battle Royale package, and it's supposed to have Battle Royale 2. Since you guys have seen Battle Royale 2, I haven't yet. Maybe some thoughts on that.
Where we left the kids from the first movie was two main characters out in the world. And I was like, oh my God, they're going to be able to bring the revolution from the little island back to Japan itself. And then they kind of really backtrack, and we got a redo of the first movie, though not nearly as good. That's my takeaway from it. But John, what were your thoughts on Battle Royale 2?
You know, obviously the film isn't about, you know, 9/11 in any kind of a manner, but, you know, some of the activities in the film are things that, as in the interview with Linda Hoagland that you had, they can be considered, you know, now as terrorist activities. So I just kind of thought that the time, you know, well, this isn't going to turn out well, maybe. And then when I watched the film itself, you know, it's not as strong as I had imagined. And I think many people agree it's quite disappointing when compared to the original. And I would say is no worse than, let's say, a Battle Royale ripoff film, of which there are several, both Japanese and in some ways American, as we said, with Hunger Games.
So, Rob, in short, you're not missing anything.
Thanks, guys.
No problem.
What were the sort of Battle Royale riffs, John, that you had kind of alluded to?
There's one that just came out last year by the name of The Insight Mill. There's another one that's kind of Battle Royale-ish that I've mentioned to you guys. It's named Kaiji, and it's actually based on a manga of the same name. And I wouldn't say it's directly Battle Royale-like, but it does have some elements. I believe it, you know, instead of an island, they're on some sort of like a gambling cruise or something. Another one that came out closer to the release dates of Battle Royale was Tokyo 10 Plus 1, which was a film, if I remember correctly, by Higuchinsky, the guy who basically directed Uzumaki. And even that might really excite people to hear that, but actually Tokyo 10 Plus 1 is kind of a terrible film with some really terrible camera work. You could fit Battle Royale 2 in the same group, and strange enough, it's probably the even though I haven't seen The Insight Mill just yet, you know, I would say it's probably the best out of these Battle Royale alikes.
We should probably talk about the score a little bit. It's very overwrought a lot of times, which I love. And I think it fits perfectly with what's going on screen.
The classical score was composed by Masamichi Amano, who's pretty famous in Japan. And he's done scores for other films as well as video games. And of course, he's done full on, orchestral runs, etc. The score itself is very German influenced, Teutonic, has that very militaristic feel to it, which is, really fits in with the theme of the film, because again, we're talking about, kids are supposed to be killing each other. I think part of the use of the score was to evoke World War II in a way.
To use, I guess, a cliched term, very Wagnerian, very operatic. The music is pretty much throughout every frame of this movie. There's very few parts of this film that doesn't have a score underneath it. And I think what Fukuzaka is trying to bring across with the use of that music, and also with music throughout the whole thing, is to see this as high drama, to see this as operatic.
So, John, this was based on a book, and then I imagine that the manga came afterwards, correct?
Actually, the novel came out in 1999. The author, his name is Koshun Takami. I think what you can say about the novel in comparison to the film, at least, is that the film is very much a bare bones version of the novel. And that's not to say that it's missing stuff. They took basically, I guess you could say, the best elements of the book, the ones that would ring true to the theme of the entire story. I kind of think that the book is maybe a little longer than it should be. The manga itself, I started reading it. I got through a couple of the first two volumes, of which there are 15 of the English version, and I actually didn't like it very much. It follows the novel very well, but I don't really like the artwork in it. It's not my taste, so I'm probably just going to give up on that, since I'm already reading the novel and can get enough out of that. There was a lot of merchandise at the time put out for this film, things like branded clothing and art books, posters, manuals that actually went into details about the film and about the characters and things like that. It's a big surprise there actually wasn't a video game. One thing that's kind of funny is that a lot of these products were basically put out for this sort of counterculture, this sort of youth counterculture or subculture that, that was happening at the time where, again, the kids were feeling a little disenfranchised. In a way, that's kind of ironic, because you have basically these products that are being marketed to kids, who are counterculture. But these products are, of course, are coming from what the big corporations, et cetera, who just want to make a quick buck, So this sort of, going around in a full circle in a way.
Yeah, it seems very strange, to be marketing to the disenfranchised. So it's like the kids who would ignore the marketing or should ignore the marketing the most. But Rob, I know that when you and I talked about Battle Royale forever ago, I kind of put it in context with Series 7 and Punishment Park. I'd written about the three films together as all kind of speaking to one another. So I was curious what your thoughts were about that now that we've kind of come to the end of this people killing people cycle.
Well, people who kill people are the luckiest people. Isn't that what Barbra Streisand told us?
Yes, yes.
What Battle Royale represents is the place where these really kind of heavy ideas of Punishment Park comes together with some of the satirical elements of Series 7. But we are put into the context with Fukuzaku's hand, where this is not directed as a show for television. This is obviously a feature that we're used to seeing. So I think in that way, it probably is a more accessible film for people. If they can't get that context and those, maybe the language idea of pseudo-documentary or even reality television, the one thing that's a little bit interesting from the aspect of where it kind of plays the game aspect is with the titles on screen that kind of tell you who's died and what number they are and how many are left and things like that. So that kind of brings that game element in there and still plays that game aspect. As for the overall ideas, I think they all kind of line up in sort of a Venn diagram way, kind of share little elements with each other. And maybe if you could kind of blend all three together, you would have the one massive film on some sort of discussion on society and all of the ways that a society would try to, incentivize others to eliminate one another for political or social reasons.
I don't mean to correct you, Rob, but that film already exists and it's called The Running Man.
There you go.
I like those on-screen titles, which do kind of take it back to the other films that we had mentioned, especially Series 7. But I also like the on-screen titles that you get, which are kind of like little echoes of dialogue. And that kind of goes back to, for me, it seems like maybe it would go back to the book where you're almost reading another line of dialogue over again, or like it's put apart from the rest of the text and it's put in italics to kind of draw attention to it. You know, these kind of, I think it only happens maybe three or four times throughout the film.
Those on-screen texts to me also kind of echoed, and obviously he was doing it for a completely different reason, but it reminds me of some of the stuff that Godard used to do, especially like Weekend, where he would have all this text on screen in the middle of the narrative. So, but I understand it, you know, definitely highlighting an emotion or an idea in the one character who's dying. She's like dying in the arms of the boy, and there's something like on screen that says, I wonder if something like, I wonder if I can tell him this one last thing or something like that. And you get the idea that maybe this on-screen text at that moment is the subtext of what that person is thinking within Battle Royale.
Back to what Rob was saying about there being a Venn diagram, I think you'd have to acknowledge that, you know, all these films that we're talking about here kind of go to the one source of being, you know, the most dangerous game, right? Which is sort of the ultimate of the human hunting types of storylines. And I had a little trivia point for you guys that I wanted to ask you. Now, I haven't seen Series 7 myself, but I do remember seeing it on the rental video shelves when I was living in Japan. And can you guys guess what they named the film over in Japan?
Battle Royale 7?
I was going to say that maybe the tagline would be like, it's like Battle Royale, but from America. I don't know.
The title was Series 7, The Battle Royale.
Nice. So,
there's something to chew on.
All right, so we're going to take a break and play a preview from next week's show.
In 1990, the makers of Basket Case and Brain Damage bring you...
Want a date?
Franken Hooker. Jeffrey Franken has a plan.
I just want to bring him back.
He has the ingenuity.
I need female body parts.
He has everything he needs, except the raw materials.
Just hold still. Excellent. Oh, my God. Bunyan!
Wow! Jeffrey's creation is alive.
Look for some action?
Oh, yeah.
He's sexy.
On a date, you're going out?
I'm on my way home, but thanks anyway.
And she's so jerked to please.
Listen, I'm looking for a very tall, attractive woman. She's purple. She's got fresh bars on her.
She's in the bar!
Now, a motion picture like no other. A tender story of love and romance.
On a date?
A gripping tale of lust and revenge. Some assembly may be required.
Be sure to check back next week when Rob and I chop up some hookers to make the perfect woman while we discuss Frank Henenlotter's Frankenhooker. Mr. Henenlotter will stop by to give us some pointers. Rule number one, no bunions. I want to thank both of you guys for coming on this week and talking about Battle Royale. John, last time you were here when we did the show on Kurosawa's High and Low, and you were just about to head off to the Land of the Rising Sun. Now that you're back in the States, what kind of good stuff can folks expect when they head over to vcinemashow.com?
Well, yeah, I was in Japan in December to meet my future in-laws. And, you know, besides that, there are a number of things from that trip that I'm trying to process into articles, one of them being a pilgrimage of sorts to Ozu's grave, Yasujiro Ozu, the great Japanese director. So this and other Asian film commentary, including reviews, features, etc., can be found on our site. And we have our own podcast called The V Cinema Show. And that's available through basically the same venues as the projection booth. So iTunes, Stitcher, etc.
Very cool.
Well, it was great talking to you, John, and thanks for coming on and doing battle with us.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks again, guys. Be sure to catch more of the Projection Booth at those aforementioned places, iTunes, Stitcher, or via the website projection-booth.com. So now let's get on the bus and take our little field trip.